Pastor, I have a question.
Yes, sir. Oh, my God.
In reading ahead, there is multiple references made to we, us.
Yes.
And the written letters here by presumably, you said Luke.
Uh-huh.
Never mentions Luke by name. And then when names are actually identified, they never include Luke.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a possible easy explanation for some of that? I mean, when he starts to talk about the, the Thessalonians, mm-hmm. The Asians, and whatever. I mean, he names all those people specifically by name in 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then says we and us and whatever in later chapters.
Mm-hmm.
I can't seem to focus on why the names are not associated with Paul like those that are identified. So is he using it as, what's the word I'm looking for here? Present tense of his presence. But
right.
It simply, you know, in the entitlement it says Paul speaks and Paul travels to this. He never says Paul and I.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't think Luke ever uses his own name in any of his writings. So either the Gospel or the Book of Acts. So we're left, a little bit in wonder exactly who is this. Now, we know that he properly identifies himself in the same way, both in Luke and in the Book of Acts. His audience is Theophilus, and he indicates in the beginning of Acts that he wrote to you previously regarding the testimony of Christ and all the evidences of Jesus and his ministry. So what we've done and been able to do, or the church has, is recognized that the same person is the author of both. Okay. Now, who is that author? That's the question. Now, the early church attached names to the Gospels based on tradition that was handed down to them. So each of the Gospels, while not, again, identifying themselves by name as the authors, the early church had that understanding from information passed down that these were the authors of these texts. Later, of course, Paul in his epistles, he identifies himself many times in his letters to the churches. Again, they're letters, so that would be kind of the norm. But in writing a testimony regarding Christ, it wasn't the concern of them at the time that we must identify ourselves so that people have that our name attached to it. They didn't want that type of notoriety. Again, not thinking of how is this going to play out 500 years from now for the sake of validity of the text. So there's that part of it. What happens then in the book of Luke, as we've mentioned before, it starts off with the author writing in the third person, not referring to himself. We do get a couple instances, though, where he does switch to the first person. And so that would then include himself in some of the missionary journeys and situations with Paul and with the rest of his company. Okay, so what we conclude from that then is the author of Luke and Acts, we say, being the same, and also being included in some of the missionary journeys is limited then down to somebody we know was with Paul in some of those journeys. And so now, okay, you've got probably, 25 or 30 people in all of the New Testament that are actually mentioned specifically, either by Luke or by Paul as companions of Paul in his journeys. So now you got to figure out from them who fits the bill right here, right? And so we get from some of Paul's writings, he talks about Luke being with him on some of the journeys. And if you're able then to match up where these journeys are, where Paul's at when this is happening, then you can match up kind of where it falls within the book of Acts as well. And so process, not of elimination, but deduction from all this information has brought that conclusion then to Luke being the author, again, recognizing his position as a physician, but also as a historian based on the content of his writing, that he wants detail, and he does do a time marker through historical events that are going on, so people have a way to track the chronology of these events. So ultimately, then, that's how they get to that conclusion, that it's Luke, who is the companion of Paul, who's the physician, who's the historian, who's the author of these two texts. And so he does reference himself in the first person. We are with him. We are doing these things. And that's kind of come up again here in Acts 20.
Okay. Helpful? On a related question.
Yeah.
Thank you. Are you under the impression that Luke wrote what we are reading after the fact of 20 years later? Or I'm overwhelmed and impressed immensely by his attention to detail of spending one day here, and I went from this town to this town to this town, mm-hmm. three consecutive days.
Right.
And we spent 7 days here and 3 years here. And it's just, did he take a logbook and write things down as he was doing these travels, do you suspect? Or is it after the fact of Paul's death that he decided to document all of this?
Right.
What's your thoughts?
My thoughts, I think it makes sense that he is in some way taking notes along the way. Now, obviously, he can't do that for his gospel because he's not there to witness the events of Christ, at least not the early ones. But I think as he tells Theophilus, he has gone through and interviewed, you know, made the investigation into Christ's life. No doubt when anybody does such a thing, you know, as a reporter would or a journalist of some kind or an investigator, you know, you could trust your memory, but you're usually going to jot things down. Or at the end of the day, after you've had these conversations, you go back and reflect and you journal on it or something like that. So I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know what the capacity for that was in those days. They obviously wouldn't have notebooks like we would, but their memories were also a lot better than ours are too, because they didn't have the technology we do or the lack of a need for. They needed to remember things. You know, we don't have to as much. So our minds have naturally kind of, you know, weakened to that point. Well, we don't have to memorize. I mean, you guys probably have a lot of phone numbers memorized, right? Maybe not anymore. Kids today, I mean, if you have a cell phone number, do you even know your own cell phone number? See, a lot of kids don't because they never have to use it. And they don't even know anybody else's number because it's just in their phone. All they have to do is tap on the picture of the person and it calls them. Okay, so those types of things you don't have to memorize anymore. Before, though, if you wanted to call somebody, you better, you know, you could have it written down. Okay, but so those are, I think, the basic things there. Logically, yeah, I think he's writing stuff down along the way, taking some type of notes. You know, think of it as a soldier in war, you know, who's writing letters back home or documenting things, you know, just little bit by little bit, you know, but enough to jog the memory and to recall. Add to that, of course, the Holy Spirit's guidance in all of this, okay? And I'm not going to say, I wouldn't leave it fully to, you know, Luke is saying, okay, I've gone through all this, and now I'm going to sit down and go into this trance and start writing by, you know, the Spirit's going to, I mean, I think it's still more a human process too, fully human and fully divine. So put the two together, and you're going to have the outcome that we do.
He was a physician too, right?
Yeah.
So,
right.
Taking notes and prescriptions, yeah. Whatever that
is. Right. So, yeah, you figure a physician is usually intelligent and attentive to detail and very analytical, objective in reporting. So they do have to document, too, what they do all the time. Right, or at least today they do. I don't know. I'm sure they did it to some way, in some extent, in those days too. Okay. Oh yeah, this is the case for today, and this is what happened. This is what I did. You know, along those lines. Now, I don't know if we found anything like that historically or archaeologically, any type of writings of doctors, you know, documenting their treatments of patients of that era. But yeah, that would be my understanding, and I think it's. It gets a little trickier with like Matthew and John, who are actual apostles of Christ and disciples of him, one of the, you know, two of the 12, and they wrote their own gospels. I don't know if they were thinking as they're going through the ministry, you know, being trained by Jesus, well, we better write this stuff down because at some point we're going to want to compile it and sell, you know, put this out for the churches. Okay, I think they do sit down later on and reflect and go back over, especially John, who's even farther down the road, typically, we think. Okay, again, it doesn't mean, though, that he wasn't putting stuff down as he thought about it throughout the years of his ministry before he actually puts it all together into the gospel. So their memories are better than ours. And they may have, you know, still interviewed, even John, even Matthew could probably, Matthew especially, converse with some of the other disciples still and say, oh yeah, I'm trying to think back about what happened here, you know, or he, you know, if we have the account of, well, it's in Mark's gospel, the raising of Jairus' daughter, right? And only three disciples saw that. So at some point, Jesus or the three or Jairus' parents had to report this to Mark, who wasn't one of the disciples of Jesus. So they're going to be doing their interviewing. They're going to be asking, you know, what happened here? Get this account, get this story. The Holy Spirit's going to be guiding that process too. So that all this comes together and the church realizes, yeah, that's an accurate account of what happened. Or we believe it, have no reason not to. And so we're going to include that, keep it there, and say this is God's word. Okay. Yeah. Good. No, that's a fair question. Okay. Bill?
In some cases, this might be Christ sent the Spirit into the apostles.
Mm-hmm.
That's the power of the Holy Spirit and right through
us. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you go to 2 Timothy 3, which talks about all Scripture is God-breathed. So you have that under, what does that mean? Well, it's all breathed out, spoken out by God through the writers themselves. And remember, the writing of Scripture happens after the fact. Again, it's not probably documented as they go, but it's an account of what has already occurred. So it does have to line up with the events as they have happened. Okay, and if there were any mistakes that were made or any challenges in what was written, they would have been corrected before officially accepted by the churches. Okay, because people would know about that. And that's one of the arguments that you can make for the defense of the resurrection of Christ and all that took place around that. Because if there was going to be any opposition to that story, to that that report, it would have happened early on. People would have said, oh no, that's not what happened, this is what happened. Or you'd have other church groups or Christians or the disciples saying, you know, commenting, oh yeah, Mark and Luke, they wrote this, but that's not what happened. We were there, we saw it, and this is what happened. You'd have some documentation of that. There's none of that. So it's pretty widely accepted then that the accounts as found in the Gospels were accurate because there's no challenges to them. Unless somebody got a hold of the challenges and burned them all, okay, and got destroyed them, then you know, we're pretty safe in saying that's the account as they took place. Joan? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. Yeah, well, you know, we don't have much of an option because we weren't there to experience those events. But it is helpful to realize the early church, you know, the first century, and the disciples around, again, you got the 12 or 11 living disciples of Jesus who would verify these claims. Okay? And most of them were still alive at the time of the first Gospels being written. So they could have, you know, they would have been there and said, oh yeah, and then probably passed through them. You know, Mark's writing this. He's not going to just write it out on his own because he's not a disciple. Okay, and so he wouldn't write it and then just pass it out to the churches and say, hey, this is what happened. I'm sure he went, I want to make sure this is valid. We're talking about salvation here and the story of Christ. I don't want to have anybody doubt it. And so no doubt he would probably pass it through the disciples who were with Jesus for verification. Is this accurate? Is this how it, I mean, and again, he's getting his information usually from Peter, we say. So he's the one getting that from Peter's account. Peter's the chief of the disciples at the time of, you know, the early church. So they're going to challenge, or they're going to verify all that. This isn't something they're risking, you know, just on memory alone. They're going to try and get everybody's account. Let's make sure this is strong as can be, and then pass that out. Right. Well, and again, it takes faith to believe that. But you have to hear the word and have faith to believe the word is the word of God. So it's still God's doing. So yeah, we leave that as a okay, Lord, just it's your word. You do with it as you wish. Our job is simply to speak it and to get the message out there. Again, the fun thing with regard to the scriptures, again, written after the fact, whether you believe it or not, these things happened. Okay, these are historical accounts. These things did take place. Yeah, and so, and this is true of all historical events. Those who live the events don't need the written account to believe it, right? Because they lived it. Okay, the disciples of Jesus didn't need to hear from Mark's gospel that Jesus raised Jairus' daughter. Peter, James, and John saw it. Okay, so they knew it before it was actually written down that that's what was happening. And now it's us who come after the fact, who never witnessed those things, that have the scriptures to believe those things to be true. If we had no, you know, if it didn't follow logically, if this just fell out of the sky without any validity, we'd have very little reason to hold on to it. But because it was written by, we say, these individuals and has passed through the tests of time, we've got very good reason to believe it. It makes sense. There's evidence to convince us of that. Absolutely. Yeah. Donna, did you have your hand up?
I was just going to say that God had a hand in it.
Well, sure.
Yeah. Their
yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, and so it's again God's process. He's the one to make sure it all goes the way it's supposed to. And how would he stop it if it wasn't going the way it was supposed to? Well, he would, but I mean, you would think again, thinking humanly speaking, he's going to get the disciples to get a hand on it and say, "Oh, nope, that's not accurate. We got to change that." Now, he could do it more, you know, directly, immediately, as God intervening through a vision or something. But again, I think it's got to go through those natural processes within the disciples' realm to verify those claims. So and that's why you get a listing of the disciples in the Gospels, in the book of Acts, so the early church and early Christians can talk to them. They can know, yeah, these guys are the real deal. We can verify everything that's being said about Jesus through these apostles, through these disciples. Yeah, Rod?
I think there are verifications from other sources, too, like Bible, Josephus.
Right.
Thank you so much. Mm-hmm. He even gives us added information. The added information
Right. Yeah, so it's helpful. Of course, we've got the scriptures itself. Some will argue, well, that's just the Bible, and it's biased, and you can't just believe that. But there's extra biblical evidence to support a lot of this stuff in the Bible, too. And not the claim that Jesus is the Messiah. I mean, a lot of these non-Christian sources won't believe that. But the things they say match up historically with the events that did take place. So you can be sure that what's reported in here historically is accurate. And it's not just made up for the sake of argument. Okay, so that's where it's good to have the extra biblical accounts, the sources, to verify the claims of history that are here. These things did happen. And exactly as the disciples said, as the gospel writers said. Now, what does that mean? Okay, the secular people won't be able to figure that out, but the rest of the scriptures do. And they will. That does teach us that. So yeah, very helpful indeed to get that information. So, but even without it, I mean, the church can survive without that stuff. Okay, but it's helpful to remove obstacles to faith from those who don't believe. Okay, hell, look, this is, again, you look at defending the text itself, the scriptures, and the number of copies of the manuscripts that we have far surpasses anything else historically speaking. And again, studying the how we got the Bible, which we've done in other contexts, is helpful there. Because we've got copies of the manuscripts within 50 years of the original writings. The closest the secular world can get to, you know, something like the writings of Homer is like 900 years removed, and they have only a handful of copies. And that's enough, though, they think, to validate, yeah, this is what he actually wrote. If that's enough for them, 900 years with only a handful of copies, how much more then for the Christian church and for others to say, well, yeah, this is within 50 years of the original writing, and there's thousands of copies saying virtually the same thing. So that's, again, your evidence. It's surpassing. It's monumental. Should be convincing. But it's the hardened of heart, of course, that say, nope, still not good enough.
The Dead Sea Scrolls.
Okay. Yeah. So, again, not necessary, but helpful, right? And they come discover these things. Archaeology does the same thing. That's been a great tool. You uncover these pieces of the past. The smoking gun, I think, as Paul Meyer likes to call them, right? You see these things from the past. Oh, yeah, this is here, and that lines up with what we said actually did happen. And so that's helpful to see that these locations were real, these people were real, things like that. Dead Sea Scrolls, all sorts of that writing that got us even closer to the original texts, date-wise, but it lined up with what we had even later. Not much of a change to show that it was faithfully copied and translated through the history. Yeah. Good? Okay. to the text at hand, verses 1 through 6. Let's get that read. Would somebody like to read 20 verses 1 through 6, please? Terry, go for it. Oh, yeah, those are fun.
After the uproar ceased, Paul sent for the disciples. And after encouraging them, he said farewell and departed for Macedonia. When he had gone through these regions and had given them much encouragement, he came to Greece. There he spent 3 months, and when a plot was made against him by the Jews as he was about to set sail for Syria, he decided to return through Macedonia. So Peter, the Berean, son of Hyrus, accompanied him, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus, and Secundus, and Gaius, and of Derbe, and Timothy, and the Asians,
Tychicus,
and
Trophimus. That worked.
Yeah, these went on ahead and were waiting for us at Troas. But we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and in 5 days we came to them at Troas, where we stayed for 7 days.
All right, so lots going on there, right? Just so you can see, the Greek pronunciations, so Tychicus is where we get Tychicus from. Trophimus is basically that. So that's where that came in. Timothy, we know. That's a diphthong there. It would be Gaios, would be his name. Secundus, Aristarchus, Sopatras. Peru is his name. Beroias is the Berean's name. So those are the Greek pronunciations and what we translate then as into the English. So this is kind of a segue into the next section, but giving some historical context, background of Paul's travels and moving forward. So the uproar that took place was what again? Back in. Was that in Ephesus? Yeah. So we're dealing with Artemis and the silversmiths and the complications there with people leaving the worship of Artemis and thus leaving the business of silversmithing, and so people getting upset by that. You had the conflict there, kind of the riots in the streets, people not knowing why they were gathering, but wanting to see this come to an end. And you had the proconsul finally stand up, or the clerk of the city say, "We've got proper channels for this. This has got to stop, this rioting. If you have a concern, a complaint, go to the proper channels. Go to your judge or your court system and make your complaints officially in that sense. We've got to maintain order. Otherwise, we'll be charged with rioting by the Roman government, and that will cause even more control from them from the outside working in, which none of the provinces under the Roman authority really wanted. They wanted to be left alone." Okay, so that's in Ephesus, which happens just before chapter 20. So after this uproar ceased, Paul sends for the disciples. Who are the disciples here? Well, they'll be listed out following. So it's not the 12. It's any of those who are the followers of Christ whom he's going to name here specifically. it could be Gentiles. It doesn't have to be necessarily, not just by that word. But yeah, after encouraging them, he said farewell and departed for Macedonia. So it's the disciples of Jesus that are currently in that location, and of those, he's going to pick some out to go with him or to send ahead of him. Okay. When he had gone through those regions and had given them much encouragement, he came to Greece. We should have our, let's see, map up here. I can detach it here. Open in a floating window. Woo! Okay. I think I can do that. And zoom. So we got Ephesus down here. again, here's full Asia at that time. It doesn't go beyond this border. Asia Minor here, then it would be down to the southwest and along the coast. So we got Paul in Ephesus there initially. He wants to get back over to Macedonia. Hey, where Philippi's at in Thessalonica. And this is Berea, where was it Aristarchus was from? Okay. he wants to get back to Syria, but he's going to go via Macedonia. So again, remember the flow of travel in those days. You couldn't just hop on a boat and get it to go wherever you wanted necessarily, especially if you wanted, you know, you could do that today with an airplane, right? But if you may have a custom or private jet, it costs a lot more money to go right exactly where you want to go and avoid the headaches. But if you can't afford that type of travel, then you got to kind of get coach fare and get on wherever it's going and find a roundabout way to get there ultimately. Okay, so he's going to get on here in Ephesus and make his way back over to Macedonia. Sorry, I still got a frog in my throat. When he had gone through those regions, given them much encouragement, he does come to Greece as he goes through Macedonia. So Macedonia is a little separate from Achaia. Down in Achaia then, or Greece, you've got Corinth and Athens, where he's been before already. What's that? Yeah, it's modern-day Greece, because Athens is here in Corinth. Achaia, this is all what we would consider a Greece today, okay, a Greek province in that sense. Athens is where, that was Mars Hill, right? Where he's in Athens, and that's where Mars Hill, the story there takes place, where he's up, I believe, in the Areopagus, okay. So he's going back through those areas. He's back into Greece. There he spends 3 months when a plot was made against him by the Jews as he was about to set sail for Syria. So he's down here in Greece and wants to get back to Syria, which is down, of course, across the Mediterranean. Okay. So how does he get word of this plot against him? Probably. We don't know for sure, but you've got favorable people that are favorable to Paul that are probably hearing of these things. And so a report does get back to Paul that there's a plot against him. We don't know exactly what that plot includes at this point. If they were going to try and kill him or get him arrested or in trouble with more governments or something like that. But it makes Paul decide, okay, well, I'm going to go here, but now I'm going to go back through Greece and Macedonia rather than go straight across through to Syria. Okay, so he decided to return through Macedonia. And so now he lists out Sopater, the Berean, son of Pyrrhus, accompanied him. Of the Thessalonians, so Thessalonica up here, we've got Aristarchus and Secundus. Aristarchus received attention and was named before, we think, back in, was it Acts 19, where he's brought out him and Gaius in the theater, right, to be publicly chastised or punished for their role in this Demetrius silversmithing issue. Okay, now, neither of them are seriously injured, at least not to the point of being prohibited from joining Paul in this journey. Okay, so Aristarchus is there with Secundus of the Thessalonians. We have Gaius of Derbe. Now, we had a Derbe farther back. Where is that at? I think it was over. Yeah, there's a Derbe there, okay, which would indicate that Gaius is not the same Gaius as was over in Ephesus, right? Or Ephesus, is that's where it was taking place. It could be, but there's also, I don't know if it showed up here. Another way that that could be translated, because the Greek word for that, again, I had to dock it. Hang on. Dock. No, not that. There it is. The Greek for derby there is, right, that one. Is derbios, which could be a different word than Derbe itself, another town that was actually in the Macedonian area or the Asia Minor area. So it could be the same guy, should be the same guy, as we would think, as was over there in Ephesus when he was put in the theater for accusation. Okay, Okay, so we have then Aristarchus and Secundus, Gaius of Derbe, and Timothy. Timothy we've been introduced to before, right? We know as the young man he got into the faith back there, Macedonia area, I believe. Okay. Then the Asians, Tychicus and Trophimus. These all, then, this is his group of disciples that he's called and gathered. These go on ahead and we're waiting for us. Oh, now we've got us again, right? So this is a switch back to the first person. And so we would say then what, based on that? Okay. That Luke is now at least back with them. So he could be one of these that's accompanying the disciples or the Paul back to, well, we would say Syria, if that's where they're heading, okay, which is what ultimately they want to get to. Okay. So that was, oh, Troas is there up on the western, northwestern coast of Asia. Okay, so they're working around through Macedonia and getting ahead or getting back to Troas. They're going to go ahead of Paul and meet him there. I don't think that's going to help me. Oh, yeah, it did help me. Good. All right. So they go ahead of Paul to Troas, but we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread, and in 5 days came to them at Troas, where we stayed for 7 days. Hey, caught all that? All right, so they're going to sail ahead from Macedonia here, after they've picked up and sent on these other guys to Troas, but we remain back in. But we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread. So Philippi being here, the other guys are sent ahead. They stay in Philippi through the days of unleavened bread. What are the days of unleavened bread? Passover. Yeah, most likely the Passover celebration. So about what time of year is this? Okay, so we think of in the spring, the March time into April. Okay, so the weather would be better for traveling at that point. You're not in the colder months of winter, and spring hopefully would be a little more temperate, easy to sail at that time. Okay, so they said they're going to stay there through the days of unleavened bread. In 5 days then we came to them at Troas. So from Philippi, sailing to Troas is about a five-day journey. Okay, so they get there in 5 days and come to Troas where we stayed for 7 days. Okay, so 7 days being a full week's time. All clear? Questions or comments on that? Got a picture of what's going on at least a little bit? Now, what are they trying to accomplish? Okay, Paul and this group of disciples, what are they working toward? What are they trying to do? Good. Okay. Yeah, so think of it, again, Paul's done a missionary journey. He's going back, he's getting to churches he's been to before, talking to some new places as well. But in the process of speaking the gospel and speaking in the synagogues and winning people to the faith, this isn't just, here's the gospel, now do what you want. This is what it means to be part of the church, right? And so here's some information about your brothers and sisters in Christ in Jerusalem and in these other places. And when they hear that there's a need there, then by the power of the gospel, they're moved to take a collection. And they want to help those who are poor back home or back in Jerusalem, okay, where other Christians are at as well. So they make that collection, and now Paul and these other disciples are going to receive that and take that back personally, okay, so that they make sure that it gets there. This also provides Paul an opportunity to get back to the other disciples that he's seen before, okay, and he does take those chances to visit other churches he's been to help strengthen them again in the faith, because no doubt they're hearing other things, conflicting reports, differing rumors of the faith, different false teachings will pop in, even in those days. So Paul gets a chance to reaffirm them in the faith before he gets back to Jerusalem. Okay, now this is helpful, again, in understanding kind of the flow of Paul's early missionary journeys. He's not there to stay for 10 years, 15 years. Okay, he goes to these places, and then he makes a trip back to the Promised Land, to Jerusalem, to share about what's been going on, up to Antioch in Syria as well. Again, Antioch is kind of where he really wants to get, because that's the home of the home of the early Christian church. They're first called Christians. Okay. So it also gives us an idea, too. Modern day, we had this discussion at our pastors or the district convention the last couple of days talking about mission work. And you know, our synod has fallen into some financial struggles in the last decade. And so they did have to call home half of our missionaries that were out in the field. Costs of supporting missionaries, I'm sure, have gone up in recent years. And so support for missionaries hasn't gone up along with that. And so the synods had to make some tough calls in bringing some of those people back home. And one of the concerns or complaints, I guess, from one of the pastors was, you know, you have to allow these guys to be there or gals to be there for long periods of time to get anything really done or accomplished. Because sometimes people don't get their families into the church or active, you know, until the, you know, it's been a few years worth of work that's there. So for them to, like Deaconess Kim, who, you know, the plan is she raises money, she goes there and she's there for 2 years or a little bit more, and then has to come back and replenish that, those funds and that support, and then go back rather than be there for 10 or 15 years. Well, how could you today stay on in a place like that for 10 or 15 years? Okay, you'd have to have support, okay, outside, or, I mean, how would you live in any other part of the world if you wanted to? Yeah, you have to go to work there, okay? Now, I don't know what it used to be like for missionaries in the 50s, 60s, 70s. I know some who were over in those parts of the, you know, of the world, in Africa and in Asia. I don't know if what they were doing work outside of the ministry that was there. They were receiving enough support from the synod that they didn't have to do that work. I don't know how that all played out. But those are other ways, even in this country, where certain congregations may not be able to afford the full pastoral salary, then those pastors will go to work part-time to help lighten that load for the congregation, which allows them to stay and do their work without having to leave and find greener pasture somewhere else. So that would be something that, you know, Paul, again, he's trying to supplement or provide enough income for himself that these churches don't have to pay for him. Again, he's not recommending that or requiring that of other pastors or missionaries, but that is an option that he takes advantage of so that it doesn't burden the churches around him. So I would say if that's the case in these countries, you know, if I would have wanted to be a missionary in Africa, I wouldn't just go and think, oh, I'll have all the support I need from back home. Find a way to make ends meet there too. It should be, I mean, it's not easy per se, but you wouldn't need as much there as you're used to having here. Your utility bills and the other things you pay for here, you're not going to be paying for there. So what you would need to survive or live there isn't going to be as much overall. Now, again, I don't know what goes into the costs that a missionary has in some of those areas. I know Deaconess Kim, I think she was supposed to raise like over $100,000 for being there for 2 years. So I don't know what that covers or why it needs to be so much. I'm sure there's a good reason for that. So things may be a little different now than they were even 50 years ago, how you support a missionary. Nonetheless, Paul was able to do quite a bit and accomplish quite a bit in the shorter amount of times he had in these areas, with the intent of going back to them, but also with the intent of establishing churches where he's at, getting pastors to take over in those areas after they've been properly trained, and then leaving and moving on. Okay, so it wasn't his intent ever to stay in a certain area for too long of a time. Okay, kind of as long as you're there, as long as you're welcome there, then you stay there and you do your work, but then you're going to be moving on. That was Paul's approach to that as a missionary. So, Herm, go ahead. Okay. Yep.
In fact, I remember one in Springfield who was filled the armory right across from Trinity.
Wow. Cool. Yeah, so was that like for just one day? Was that a week-long event? One day, and did it invite other churches from the area? Okay. I know, I think now they want churches to have a mission Sunday to focus in on what the church, this church is doing. I think one of the things, too, we've talked about at our convention, is getting more of our congregations aware of all that our districts are able to do, all that the synod is actually doing. I think a lot of members in the church don't really know what's going on in these entities beyond our own congregation. And we probably don't even, I don't even know what our money does for the missions we support, you know, with the Jamaican ministry, with the Latvian church, and even with Deaconess Kim. So it's nice to get those reports back, like Paul is doing with these other disciples, so that now you know what's going on. And when you know those things, yeah, I can see what's actually happening, you're much more inclined to continue that support. And so there's a definite benefit there in getting back to these information back to these places. Okay. And so that's the plan. Other questions, comments on that? Donna? Right. Exactly. Yeah, so he was the tent maker, continued on in that. Now, again, he'll write in his epistles that the pastor should receive his pay from the congregation. Okay, so a pastor should not have to work. That doesn't mean that's going to happen in every situation. Again, there are going to be places where congregations can't afford that, or they'll have to team up with another congregation to pay for a full-time pastor. So you'll have dual parishes, some even triple parishes, to make that happen. Okay, so yeah, Paul's doing that as a way to prevent a burden on the congregation personally, but he doesn't say that's how it should be, that every pastor has to get his money from outside the church. But actually, that's where the income should come from for the pastor. So that's clear. But yeah, Paul is working to avoid that. And others can do that too if the church. Now, if I said that, I could go to the church council, I could go to the elders and say, I'm going to go to work, you know, 30 hours a week outside of the church to help provide money for the rest, you know, my family and other things. What would the reaction of the congregation be? Well, we need you here. We're paying you to do the work of the pastor here, preach and teach and visit our sick and get the, you know, the stuff done here that the pastor needs to do. You know, so I think there would be some kind of a prohibition there. That's not why you're here. And if, you know, you're doing that, then we obviously aren't going to get the full output that we expected from the one pastor. Okay. So that's kind of the thought process behind that, I guess. What's going on? Okay, so Paul and the disciples are looking to get back to Syria to make their report. They end up in Troas here at the end of verse 6. And so they stay there for 7 days. Now, moving forward into 7 through 12, let's have somebody read 7 through 12 for us. Yeah, Virginia, go for it.
I'll try this. And on the first day of the week, when we were gathered together to break bread, Paul talked with them, intending to depart on the next day, and he prolonged his speech until midnight. There were many lamps in the upper room where we were gathered, and a young man named Eutychus, sitting at the window, sank into a deep sleep as Paul talked still longer. And being overcome by sleep, he fell down from the third story and was taken up dead. But Paul went down and bent over him, and taking him in his arms, said, "Do not be alarmed, for his life is in him." And when Paul had gone up and had broken bread and eaten, he conversed with them a long while until daybreak, and so departed. And they took the youth away alive and were not a little comforted.
Okay, good. So the first day of the week, we would say that is what day?
Sunday.
Okay. So on Sunday, when we were gathered together to break bread, what are they doing?
Celebrating.
They could be having a meal, but what is the code here that Luke is using and the church has used and the New Testament has used for? What does this represent? Right. Right. So the first day of the week, and they're gathered together to break bread. So it's Sunday, and they're worshiping. Okay, it's there for the divine service. Now, does it look like our divine service? Not exactly, right? Not going to have the same flow, the same type of situation, okay? But they're gathered together, probably in somebody's home. Again, this is Troas, where they're at. Paul is talking, and what time of day is this?
Night.
Hmm? Okay, it's at night. So that was pretty common in the early church. Okay, they didn't have church in the morning on Sunday. Why?
Too hot.
It could be too hot. If they do it early enough, it wouldn't be so bad. But why else? Okay, could be a way, so they would need time to get there. Could be possible. What else? Working, okay? So we don't have a weekend like we have now. right? Now, if they're following Jewish customs, Sabbath would have been their day off. Okay, but a lot of the early Christians would be working on Sundays. Most of the best work is done early on in the day, so their time to meet for worship would be later on. Okay, so after they've had time to work. Of course, that means then if you've worked most of the day before you go to church, then you're pretty worn out and tired. And even kids in those days, Eutychus the youth, would have probably had some type of a job that he was doing, whether it be publicly or at home with his family. Okay, so nonetheless, he's there. Present when Paul is speaking, intending to depart the next day. So worshiping on Sunday, intending to leave on Monday. We don't know exactly what time Monday, but you would think, oh, he's got to leave the next day. Well, you better get some sleep. But nonetheless, it doesn't stop him. He continues to speak. Now, again, this is a little different than our normal service, where some pastors would preach, you know, 30 minutes to an hour, but typically now we keep things concise, limit that down. That wasn't Paul's concern at the time, so he's speaking, prolonging his speech until midnight. Again, I don't know how they count hours through the night, but it's I'm sure you have a sense of time in your head, you know, how much time has passed. Even if you didn't have a clock, you could think, well, I've been up for this amount of time, the sun's been up, okay, I know it's about this time. Okay, so it's about midnight that Paul is continuing on in his speech. Many lamps in the upper room where they were gathered. You could probably also indicate some time passage through how long your lamps are lasting, right? You know how much oil is consumed in a certain amount of time, and we're, okay, well, this is still fresh, or we've gone through, we had to replenish now, so it's been about 4 hours, give or take. Okay. Something like that, you probably have ways to challenge or to figure that out in those days. But they are in an upper room now. What does that indicate? This is now Asia Minor, though, right? Or in Asia, not in Jerusalem. Okay, so it's not necessarily the same architecture in that region as back in Jerusalem or Israel. Okay, but nonetheless, they're in an upper room, and it says here the third floor is from where Eutychus fell. Okay, so you think of, even in Israel, you could consider the upper room or the upper level of a home as the third floor. If you had as the very bottom the place where the animals stayed, that would be the first floor. And then the main level where you'd walk into normally would be where all the work takes place in the home, where people would dwell mostly. And then up above would be your guest area or your more general meeting space, which would be considered the third floor. So probably a similar type of structure as back in Israel. It doesn't have to be exactly the same, but that's where they are meeting. This is also the same type of idea of location where Jesus celebrates the Lord's Supper with his disciples. Okay, not that that's what they're trying to accomplish there. We got to worship in the same place Jesus did, the upper room. But that's where it's convenient, where there's most space for people to gather that's not occupied by other more useful things in the main level of the home. Okay, so they're up there on the third floor in the upper room where everyone has gathered. Again, this is Troas. This is probably in April, so probably not too warm yet, but it is Mediterranean climate, right? So it's still temperate or moderate and not that you're freezing, but warm enough. It's through the night. We don't know what kind of night it was, but when you're up on the third floor, it's going to be typically warmer because heat rises. Okay, so through the night, you've been working all day, you're hearing Paul talk, and of course, we don't know what kind of voice Paul had, if he was mesmerizing in his speech, if he was able to keep people awake the whole time or not. Obviously not for Eutychus. Okay, so if you hear somebody talking for any length of time, you start to wander off, drone off, might even put you to sleep more regularly or easily. And so a young man named Eutychus, sitting at the window, sank into a deep sleep as Paul talked still longer, right? So all these things coming into effect, factor in, making this guy super tired. End of the day, hearing somebody speak in an upper room when it's dark outside, lamps burning, lamps weren't very bright, right? So all the factors in play are perfect for sleeping. Herb?
It's interesting. They say many lamps.
Mm-hmm.
And the lamps were probably taking up all the oxygen.
Good. Yeah, there you go. Right? So, yeah, if you have a fire burning, right, that's consuming oxygen, I don't know if that makes you more sleepy. I guess it probably could. I wonder if that was, you know, back in the day before heaters, you know, where you build a fire, a campfire. I wonder if that would help put you to sleep, too. Now, obviously, you want it for warmth, but consuming oxygen, and maybe that was part of it. So anyway, yeah, you've got the dim light, you've got the heat from the lamps, and you've got the upper room space, and you've got it being dark, and you've got somebody droning on, not droning on, I'm sure it was very enlightening, okay? But he's speaking on about the gospel, no doubt teaching about Jesus, about the faith, catechizing these people in the service, okay? And Eutychus there, he falls into a deep sleep while he's sitting at the window. Why is he sitting at the window? Well, could be the only place to sit. Fresh air, right? Get a draft, get a breeze. Try and stay awake that way. But then you're also by a third-story window, so that's dangerous. Okay, so after he falls asleep, being overcome by sleep, he fell down from the third story and was taken up dead. Now, is every fall from a third-story window going to end in death? No, not necessarily. So the way he fell most likely caused some type of death, causing injury. Okay, so he fell on his head or on his back or some type of neck injury, something like that. We don't know for sure, but it did lead to his death. Okay, Paul went down and bent over him. Now, again, Luke does report here that he is dead, and the Greek word there is nekros, okay, which is the word for death, and so you have that today with necromancy or whatever it might be, the word for dead. But Paul does go down, and he does bend over him. Okay, and taking him in his arms, said, I don't know what all those symbols are, but it's modern, do not be alarmed, okay, Greek word there is tharubeo, do not be, also could mean disturbed, uproar, commotion, okay, do not be alarmed, troubled, in despair, for his life is in him. Okay, psuche. Zoe is the Greek word for life. Psuche is typically the word for the soul, okay, the being itself. Okay, life is, you know, zoology, right? Zoe, anything that has life is the Zoe. But psuche is the actual human part of you, the soul, that makes you distinct from the animal kingdom. Okay, so his psuche is still within him. Okay, so that's good. Now, how does that work? So we wonder about this, right? When somebody dies, what happens to the soul, to the being? I mean, usually death means that they're separated from their soul, right? Their life has ceased. And naturally, we think there's an immediate transfer from this realm to God's realm, if you are a believer. Okay, there's no transition time. Okay, some would think, though, in Jewish culture, it would take 3 or 4 days for that fully to occur. Okay, you had to wait 3 or 4 days to be to officially declare somebody dead, because then you knew the spirit wasn't lingering anymore, okay, that it was fully gone. And what evidence do we have of that? Well, none. Now, were there times, perhaps, in the ancient world where somebody was declared dead, but oh, we have to wait long enough, and perhaps they got revived and did come back to life. Maybe they made a mistake. Maybe they didn't know for sure they were dead. Okay, those things are possible. We don't know. Okay. Nonetheless, he's declared dead or viewed as dead. Paul says, no, his psuche is still within him. Okay. We don't know exactly how that worked, but Paul, of course, maybe he's speaking simply as a disciple with the power of Christ at that time. As Jesus said regarding Jairus' daughter, she's not dead, she's sleeping. Right, but no, she really was dead, but when somebody has the power to wake somebody from death, that death is not really death. Okay, it is simply asleep. Okay, so Paul says his life is still in him. When Paul had gone up, and had broken bread and eaten, he conversed with them a long while until daybreak. Now, it doesn't say when he rose. Right? So there's no miracle that we see any type of action of Paul. Right? Paul went down, bent over him, taking him in his arms, said, not be alarmed, his life is in him. That's it. Later on, they take the youth away alive, and we're not a little comforted. How did this happen?
He stayed with them the rest of the night.
Okay.
Obviously, watching him recover would be my best guess.
Okay. Oh, yeah, and we don't know what type of how long a recovery would take, okay, but usually when a resurrection occurred, they're ready to go. Okay. Yeah. I'm sure they kept him away from the window, Didn't want to see that happen again. Okay. And yeah, it's a strange mystery. But nonetheless, there, he's viewed as dead, but now he's alive again. So Paul has this miracle attached to him of being able to raise the dead. Okay. But we don't know exactly how he does it. No words were spoken, no special touch or outreach, nothing like we have in the Gospels when Jesus raises somebody from the dead. But he does bend over him, and there's a little footnote there. It's referencing, from 1 Kings, which would be 17. I believe that's the story of Elisha raising the widow's son. Or that could be Elijah. 1 Kings 17, 21. Yeah, that's Elijah raising the widow's son. There in 21 it says, he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord, let the child's life be restored to him. So they're saying a similar word is being used there, or may have been translated as the same thing from back in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. So the Greek word there is epipipto, okay, which is to fall on, throw oneself upon. It can also mean bent. But yeah, there is that idea of falling upon or pressing on or embracing, which is what Elijah does. So perhaps this is the way that Paul will use to raise this boy back to life as well. Bends down onto the child, throws himself on him, taking him in his arm, says, be not alarmed, for his life is in him. Maybe that's the word that is needed to raise him. Simply the declaration that you are alive. Okay? He's not dead. His life is in him. Okay? Similar to the declaration of the absolution. Right? Simply declaring your identity, your reality, your sins are forgiven. Okay? It's already there. It's already accurate. By that word, though, you have your sins forgiven. Okay? That's the power. Okay, so this boy is raised to new life, and when Paul had gone up, broken bread and eaten, so back to the Lord's Supper they go. He conversed with them a long while until daybreak, so on and on they go, right, into the service and through the nights, continuing on in education and training, and until daybreak, and so departed. And they took the youth away alive and were not a little comforted, they being those who were gathered in that building, that upper room, to hear the service. Okay. And there's our little use there of Luke's again. They were not a little comforted, right? The Greek there states it as, and they were comforted, not a little. So there you go. Okay, which means a lot, right? So, the story of Eutychus has inspired a book that was written a number of years back by John Oberdeck, called Applied Theology for Youth Ministry, called Eutychus Youth. Okay, so it says, the young man at the center of a tragic and miraculous event recorded in Acts 20 and the picture of adolescent development in the 21st century. So, pass that around, take a look at it, but that's influential, at least the story, getting them some attention for Eutychus. Okay, so that ends that section. Any questions or comments on the raising story there? Of Eutychus being raised from the dead. Okay. Then moving forward, 13 through 16. Oh, Joan, go ahead. Well, I think it's not necessarily what we would think of as a sermon today. Back from Acts 2:42, they gathered around the apostles' teaching and the fellowship, the breaking of bread and the prayers. That was the nuts and bolts of the divine service early on in the church. So this is the apostles' teaching part. Now, it could probably, I'm sure, again, they had lots to teach, a little bit of amount of time with these people. And when you haven't heard the gospel before, all this is brand new, and you really have that fire, that spirit within you, you don't want to stop. Right? You want to keep learning. You want to keep holding on to that, and as much as we can get. Paul's going to be leaving soon. We want to hold him as long as possible. Okay, so these apostles are there, and he's an actual apostle, so they've really got him. You get somebody famous that's really well-respected and revered, and not just somebody else, you know, underneath, and yeah, we want to hold on to him as long as we can. Yeah. It's the teaching of the faith, right? The catechesis, the doctrine that they're gathered around. Paul's the one speaking it to them, and he's willing to go on as long as they want him to, and they're not showing any signs of stopping. And so he continues on. Yeah, a lot to teach, a lot to say before he moves on from them, which will happen the next day. Okay, so verses 13 through 16, a reader for that? Oh, we're at 11:30, so didn't quite get through 20 like I wanted to, but let's end this section here. Okay, but going ahead to the ship, we set sail for Assos, intending to take Paul aboard there, for so he had arranged, intending himself to go by land. When he met us at Assos, we took him on board and went to Mytilene. Sailing from there, we came to the following day opposite Chios. The next day, we touched at Samos, and the day after that, we went to Miletus. For Paul had decided to sail past Ephesus so that he might not have to spend time in Asia, where he was hastening to be at Jerusalem, if possible, on the day of Pentecost. Okay, so if you think about all this taking place following the days of unleavened bread, so Passover, how much time is there between Passover and Pentecost? 50 roughly 50 days. So it takes 5 days to journey from one spot to Troas, and it wasn't that far. So just the travel itself would probably take the better part of a month to get there. And so he can't linger too long in any specific spot and decides we're not going to even stay any length of time really there in Asia, right? Because we got to move forward and get to, he wants to get to Jerusalem in time for Passover or Pentecost. Okay, so he skips then, Ephesus, that's where he skips. So he might not have to spend any time in Asia, again, that whole region, that area, and getting back then for the day of Pentecost. So 50 days between Passover and Pentecost, a bulk of that is just in the travel itself. There's not much time to get suspend in each location. He does spend there 7 days, a week in Troas before he heads out, okay, down to Assos, and then to Mytilene, through Chios and Samos, through Miletus, and then skipping over all then of Asia and not wanting to go into Ephesus because that's, again, big city, a big church, a lot of conversations I'm sure could be had there, and then moving forward back down to Syria or to Jerusalem, to Israel. Okay, so Paul then giving, again, background information, travel times, just so you get an idea. Again, recording actual historical spots, geographical locations, lending credence, credibility to the writing itself. Herb?
It'd be interesting to know the distances this all comes.
Yeah, I thought about that, too, and I will try to come up with that. We meet again in 3 weeks, right? So we'll come back, actually 4, I guess, from now. So it'll be the August 7th, I think, is the day, or 6th, something like that. First Tuesday in August. Because July 31st is Tuesday, and then Wednesday is August 1st, and so it'll be August 7th is that Tuesday, right? Because August 5th is Sunday, the first Sunday in August, and so, yeah. Because we're going to be, we don't get back in town until July 31st, which is Wednesday. Okay. No, wait, not Wednesday. I probably got something wrong. Oh, hang on. Just hang on to what we've got. Let's see, I think I have my calendar here. And go to month. All right, so we get, August 1st is Wednesday. We get back on the 31st, so we wouldn't have class then, and so we don't have class that week at all. So we're off the next 3, 17th, 24th, and 31st, back then for class on Tuesday the 7th.
August the 7th.
August the 7th.
August 7th.
Yeah, oh, Tuesday, August. Yeah, I meant to put 7 there. Sorry, that's only one day separate. Yep. I'm fired.
It's a Wednesday, so that's
all. All right, so August the 7th is our next class after this. We'll finish up with chapter 20 there as we get to Paul's celebration there, getting to Jerusalem. But he still has some other stuff to do before he gets there because he does go to Ephesus to speak to the elders of the church, even though he didn't want to stop there. Okay, more on that next time. Any other questions, comments, concerns? All right, we'll stand to sing our doxology.
Thank you.